Welcome back to the Deacon's Den. We are so happy to be back, and that after our last episode, the first time in this new facility, they've allowed us to actually come back. Guess we didn't do too much damage to the furniture or equipment last time, Joe.
I've been told to keep my hands to myself.
Yeah, I know. We have worked out those bugs from the last episode. So anyone who listened to the last episode and thought Joe was in a different room for the first few minutes, that was his fault, not our producers. I just have to get that on record. And now we've worked out some of those bugs, though, and settled into these classy digs. So we're ready to get back into the rhythm of a more regular recording cycle. Now, today's episode is one that I have wanted to do for quite a long time, fueled by the fact that I observed an interesting correlation between the renewal of the permanent diaconate by the Second Vatican Council and the establishment of the Diocese of Orlando. And being a history nerd, basically I'm just a nerd, I wanted to dig a little deeper into the veritable twin establishment of these two institutions that are so dear to both Deacon Joe and I. And so we went to great lengths to bring in today's guest, well, at least the length of the 40-foot hallway between our offices, to invite into the den the archivist for the Diocese of Orlando, Renee Bennett. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being had. We're excited to have you here and to see what discoveries that today's journey may lead us to. So would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to our listeners with a little bit about yourself, perhaps where you grew up, what led you to becoming the archivist for the Diocese of Orlando, what you like to do when you're not playing Indiana Jones as you sight through the diocesan archives, and please do all of that in 18 and a half seconds or less. Go.
Okay, no pressure. Yeah. I'm Renee Bennett, as Deacon mentioned, and I've lived in Florida since 1972. I came down from the great state of Michigan because my father did not like driving in the snow any longer.
M go blue.
So, it's, right. Well, we were Michigan State fans, but that's okay.
Sorry
that's
about
okay.
that. Go Sparty.
So I went to school here. I attended St. Margaret Mary Catholic School, Bishop Moore. I got my bachelor's degree in history because I've always loved history, and then, but I've always loved libraries and reading. It was a big part of growing up. Went to Florida State, go Seminoles, and I have a master's degree in library and information science. So most of my career until I came to the diocese 11 years ago was in public libraries, and I worked my way up from a bookshelver to an executive assistant. Realized at that time that I really felt called to really working with the church more closely. I've always been involved with the church, but I felt called to that, and the position of archivist had opened. It was a full-time position, which obviously I needed, and I interviewed for the position, and I was blessed to have been hired, and I've been happy ever since.
And you weren't happy before that. No, that's not the question I meant to ask. When was that? What year was that you joined the diocese?
I joined the diocese in 2012, October.
So what does an archivist do?
Basically, we're sort of the caregivers of the memory of the diocese. The archive position generally is an important position in a lot of different organizations. In the Diocese of Orlando, it's actually written into canon law because the church has always been, as I'm sure you know, has always been very concerned and very mindful of the importance of history and documents and remembering where we come from, where our roots are. And so an archivist position is actually mandated in canon law. The archivist, we take care of the memory of the diocese, the people of God, the parishes, the schools, the business of the bishops, and those who are involved and who work here, their spiritual and pastoral lives. And the archivist takes care of that and preserves it and conserves it and collects it as well.
So you also collect all the sacramental records?
I do. The parishes, obviously, they are mandated to keep their sacramental records in paper form, which is also another very important thing. Even though we're in a digitized society, the paper is the authentic record. But what we do here at the diocese, and this was through the wisdom of Bishop Dorsey's one who started it, we digitize all the records. So once a year, I get the records in various forms from the parishes, and we digitize them so that we have a fallback in case, God forbid, something happened to a sacramental record. So we do digitize all those records.
And that's even shifting as we speak.
It is. It is very much. Yes.
Something struck me as you were talking, and it goes back to, I think, my European history class. You said that the church has always been, has prioritized keeping history, keeping track of history. But if I recall European history right, the church actually kept the history for Europe when all of those kingdoms were collapsing. And if it wasn't for the church, and that's where the church started keeping a lot of the records that you talked about, sacramental records. So mm-hmm. a very important job, but also for those of us that like to scrounge around in our attics and look at things before, this is you're taking care of the church's attic right here in Orlando.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of history.
But it's in the basement.
It's in the basement. Okay. That's true. Heat rises in Florida. We don't want our archives up there.
That's right.
Well, I'd like, and it was a look at history that actually prompted this this invitation, because according to my brief investigation, and admittedly, I'm not an expert, you are, that's why you're here, I found that Pope Paul VI promulgated the restoration of the permanent diaconate on June 18th, 1967. And the date of the establishment of the Diocese of Orlando was exactly 1 year later, June 18th, 1968. And then even further, but wait, there's more. It was in May 1968, the month before we were established, that the bishops of the U.S. asked permission to reestablish the order of deacons, of permanent deacons in the U.S., and permission was granted just 2 months after our diocese was formed. So my foundational question, first of all, do I have my facts right? Because if not, I need to get a new Internet Explorer.
No, you do. I would give you a check marks 100% on your facts.
Oh, good. Okay.
You
just the facts,
well.
Man. Thank you. As I said, I am a nerd, and this is what I do, just not professionally. I didn't know you could get paid for doing this stuff. This is great. I don't need another job, and you're too good at yours. So let's start by talking about, though, the foundation of the Diocese of Orlando, if we could. How does that decision even get made? Obviously, the churches of Central Florida were part of a pre-existing diocese. We weren't out there as free agents and lone rangers. So what happened? Why was the Diocese of Orlando formed? How was the decision made to create a new separate diocese? What drove the change?
Well, and as you mentioned rightly, the entire state of Florida was under the Diocese of St. Augustine. We were just one diocese. Really what happened is land boom, population boom. Florida was just bursting with growth from the 1920s and onward. I mean, people were moving down, as they still do. And really that kind of drove it. It was population, more and more Catholics. And it was really, you know, looking at it in terms of how do we serve from Rome, looking at the diocese and the Diocese of St. Augustine, how do we serve the people? How do we do that pastorally and with due diligence and due care when the population is growing and growing under one diocese? And so I think the impetus came from Rome and in dialogue with the Diocese of St. Augustine that we really need to do something. And it became apparent that, especially with the growth in the Miami area originally, the diocese, it's archdiocese now, but the Diocese of Miami was created in 1954. That was the first. And then because of the growth in Central Florida, it was growing and growing and growing. That's when in 1968, we were created along with the Diocese of St. Petersburg. So we're basically twins. We're about a day apart.
We're the better looking twin, right?
We're the better looking twin, yes, because we're not identical twins. We're fraternal twins.
Okay. Sorry, Bishop Parks and the Diocese of St. Petersburg. So that's, and there was certainly a boom. I was, as you were talking, and again, history nerd that I am, Henry Flagler, of course, caused that boom in Miami when he built the train line down there.
Oh, yes, the railroads.
And so that railroad started. And then I guess that other man with the mouse certainly helped build the boom here in Central Florida.
That continued it.
That continued
the
boom.
And then Martin Marietta moving in. Of course, the weather was always was a prime driver with different industries. And of course, the military presence was very important in Central Florida. Leading into, of course, the development of the Cape Canaveral area mm-hmm. and space. So that was all very, very important.
We're going to come back to space in a few minutes,
we are.
I think. Okay,
I hope
good.
So.
So tell us more about this fledgling diocese, the Diocese of Orlando. The year is 1968. That was a tumultuous year in this country when you think about it. Who was the first bishop? What can you tell us about the size and character of the diocese at that time? Any fascinating facts you can share with us?
Yeah, our first bishop was William D. Borders, and he was actually from the Archdiocese of New Orleans. So he was a priest at the time, so of course he was ordained as a bishop. And he was our first bishop. He was only here from 1969 to 1974. But from everything I know and then I've read and things that I've read that he's written, very pastoral, had a lot of foresight. And of course, he had a big job because he was the first bishop. And so he had to spend his years forming the internal structure. What was the diocese going to look like? Who were we going to be involved? What was the structure? Who did he want to invite in to help him with this? Just to give you a few little stats, at the time, the diocese was 12,700 square miles. The Catholic population was 87,374. We had more dioceses than we do now. The dioceses that we have, including the ones we have now, were Highlands, Indian River, Okeechobee, and St. Lucie.
Well, you're saying diocese, you're talking about counties?
Counties. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
I thought there were dioceses that had gone missing. I said, somebody tell Rome now.
They feel like it sometimes.
We are greater than we ever thought.
Yeah.
But those were the counties, so we were even much larger than we are now. Today, just to give you a comparison, from 12,700 square miles, we're now 9,600 square miles, obviously because we don't have several of those counties anymore. They went to form the Diocese of Venice and the Diocese of Palm Beach in 1984, so not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And the Catholic population, from being 87,374, is 390,668.
So quite a growth.
So quite a growth, yes.
And all those Catholics, you know, I joked when I moved here, we're at the intersection of, essentially, of I-95 coming down from New York and I-75 from Chicago. Two good Catholic populations there. Right. So all the Catholics drained south. So and came here to Central Florida. Mm-hmm. So quite a boom. That's five times as large as we were. Wow. Okay, we have to address this issue right now. Space, the final frontier. Is it true that the moon is part of our diocese?
Yes, although the
Archbishop. You sound like a politician. Yes, but.
Well, I believe it is, yes. But I have a funny story. It's very brief, and I'll just read it because I want to make sure I get it right because it's absolutely great and funny. But the Archbishops of New York and Miami had to put their oar in because they didn't want, because Bishop Borders actually went to Rome on his ad limina bishop. And Pope Paul was fascinated with this the whole space program. He would go to the observatory. He was totally, totally in. And so Bishop Borders, when he was there, he told Pope Paul, you know, I am also the Bishop of Miami, or the Bishop of the Moon. And the Pope looked a little surprised. And what he stated was the code of canon law for 1917, which said, any newly discovered territory was placed under the jurisdiction of the diocese from which the expedition which discovered that territory left. So since Cape Canaveral, launching site for all the Geminis and Apollos, was in Brevard County and part of the Diocese of Orlando, then in addition to being bishop of 13 counties at the time, he was also bishop of the moon. So it worked. But during a pre-launch banquet at Patrick Air Force Base, Cardinal Terence Cook of New York, he stated that because he was also vicar of the military ordinate with a base at Cape Canaveral, that he was actually, the moon actually belonged to him. And then Archbishop Carroll of Miami, he claimed that actually it belonged to Miami because the moon always rose over Miami.
Right. I was thinking about that. The moon over Miami, a famous.
They have claims, but I still believe it is the Diocese of Orlando that does have claim over the moon.
How many Catholics on the moon right now?
Well, learning right now, but there will be.
There will be, and hopefully have been before. That is a fun story, though, and I know that I didn't realize there were three claims.
Yep.
So that's cool. We should put in our claim, Joe. I think we can make a claim for the moon.
On what grounds?
Yeah. We can. On what grounds?
Yeah.
Because isn't our podcast, you know, transmitted to the moon as well too? So we probably have listeners out there. Okay, I think I'm just mooning over this a little bit too much, and I'm going to be considered a lunatic. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's narrow our focus now down to the permanent diaconate. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is the deacon's den, and we'd like to know more about the growth of the diaconate here in Central Florida. Have you, in your in-depth research, determined who was the first deacon to serve in this diocese?
Yes, but it was someone that wasn't ordained here.
Right, I would expect that.
Yes. We expected that.
Yeah, okay. That was Deacon Norm Kazik.
Norm Kazik.
Yes, that goes
back.
Is that
the Holy Name of Jesus?
That goes, yeah, he goes back, way back.
Good
he
job, was, Joe. Joe knew
you.
That one.
Oh, wow. He came down in 1978.
You could be an archivist.
He was a singer, too. He was one of those deacons that served and tried to sing at the choir at the same time.
Deacon Norm.
Oh, one of those.
He
okay.
loved the choir.
When he came down, it was in 1978, and they were actually involved with St. Mary Magdalene Church, and he had been ordained in 1972. So where he was, and from Illinois, they had jumped on, you know, really getting involved in the diaconate. It took us a little bit longer for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But it was actually Deacon Norm Kasich, and obviously later he was incarnated into our diocese. So he was our first one.
Hmm. Okay, Deacon Norm Kasich. Is there a plaque somewhere we need to memorize this, you know? And okay, Joe, you're in charge of that. Get a plaque made. Deacon Norm Kasich.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. And singer. Deacon and singer. So he did transfer in from another diocese, you said, from Illinois. Mm-hmm. Was it Chicago? I know who.
It was Chicago.
It was Chicago. Yeah. Okay. Not a surprise at all. So when was the first deacon ordained in our diocese?
We had 13 in the original cohort.
Well, cohort,
only
yes.
12. First cohort. Yes. It was 13.
Yes. And not just a hort that stands alone, but a cohort.
Yes, right. That's exactly right. And that was in 1981. They were ordained in 1981.
Okay, not too much later then. Right.
And I believe it was
1 year off on all my stats. I thought it was 82.
Deacon Donald Bolin, I believe, is
Don
still
Bolin.
A monk.
Yep.
And
yeah.
He was in that
He's
original
the only survivor.
Class.
The only survivor. That's a really tough way to say that, Joe. But okay, so 1981.
So 1981.
13 guys, mm-hmm. and Don Bolin, who still serves to this day.
Yes.
At the tender age of 96. I think something like that.
Is he that old? I lost track. Time flies when you're having
fun. Yeah, well, it's because you got old too, Joe. So that's why you don't remember. Okay.
And the development of the diaconate, it started a little bit later, although I think we were on par with some other dioceses. But Bishop Borders was interested in the diaconate. It was among many things that he was interested in developing, but he was trying to develop this entire diocese. So I think that's why it took a little bit longer. So once Bishop Grady came in 1974, that's when it was really started to kick off that we really need to have a permanent diaconate here. It's important for us to have that.
Okay. And you're right. The growth is, right now we are one of the larger programs in the country. We have over 200 active deacons, more than 50 now inactive deacons due to health or age. It happens to all of us. And 42 men currently in formation on a path to ordination, because those cohorts you were talking about, we start a new one every 2 years. Did the diaconate grow? You said that we got started a little late. Did it grow quickly? I'm always curious about the evolution of these.
Yeah, it did. The formation process was interesting. At the time it began, the deacons, their first 3 years, they were involved in lay ministry development. That was their first 3 years of formation. Right. They were along with other men and women that were on a path with lay ministry development. So that was important for them at the time. And then they had, after that, they would apply to go into the permanent diaconate office to further their formation. So it was 3 years of that, and then a year or two. It looked like it was a year at first, and then it expanded to 2 years for that. Mm-hmm. So it went from, you know, a handful of them. It kept growing each year. 1981, there was 13 ordained. In 1991, 10 years later, there were 87 deacons total in the diocese in terms of how many there were. By 2001, there was 130. So it has kept growing because, you know, I think not only in the discernment process of bringing men into ministry, but the recognition in the diocese that the deacons are so important to the people of God in the ministry that they provide, in the service that they provide to their communities and to their churches.
And Joe, if I remember right, you started with that lay ministry program model, correct?
Yes, I did. In 2009, our cohort had actually the last four men that went through that model.
So it was, and for you, it was 3 years in the lay ministry and then 2 years more?
And then 2 years. So we would join a discernment year and then do a practicum year.
So they felt that all of the theological and pastoral formation had been done.
And it was actually a very good program because I taught in the lay ministry while I was in discernment for the permanent diaconate.
Okay. And obviously that's evolved even more now, as we've talked about in previous broadcasts. To your knowledge, have you been able to dig up dirt on any famous people ordained here in the Diocese of Orlando? I mean, I heard an apocryphal story the other day, and I want to know if it's true.
Well, not exactly, but, and I know you love it when I say that,
Which office are you running for, Renee?
There have been, and I've never been able to document it. I have never found any documentation, but there have been murmurs about Dick Butkus.
Right.
Have you been involved? I haven't found anything that substantiated the actually even had an inquiry moment. but he was a lifelong Catholic, very devout. He moved here shortly after he retired from Chicago for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of things going on up in Chicago, so he moved down here. And he was involved at St. Peter's in DeLand, and he got involved in prison ministry. It was actually through one of the deacons. It was Deacon Dick Bazo.
Okay.
That they were friends with. I'm not sure how long they were, but they were friends. And Deacon Bazo was involved in prison ministry. So he was very involved in prison ministry. So there was always that involvement, but I didn't really see that he entered or entertained that. We did have a George Patton. However, it wasn't George Hess. It was a different George Patton. I saw the name and I thought, I don't think he's Catholic, and he would have been long gone by then. But
He may have aged out by that time.
But the variety of backgrounds, certainly, in terms of the diaconate over the years. I mean, men of just a variety of backgrounds. Mm-hmm.
Did you find any particularly intriguing backgrounds as you were researching? Or, I mean, you know, we've had a lot of attorneys. No, joking to my attorney friends. Lots of doctors.
I think what really impressed me, not about any one in particular, but just again that variety of you know, those in law enforcement. There were attorneys, but there were people in law enforcement, and they were just everyday walk of life, working in offices and working as managers or working on the line somewhere, and just them bringing in that, because that was one thing that was being sought for and desired, was men of those different backgrounds and different experiences, so they could relate to the people that they were going to be serving.
And I think there's a natural affinity or an attraction to the diaconate for people that have been in service of one kind.
Right.
Military service, obviously, is an example.
We get a lot of those.
Yeah. Law enforcement.
We're going through a doctor cycle.
Right. We are going through a doctor cycle right now, which, you know, always scares me in formation when people start diagnosing me upon first contact. Oh, are you okay today? Well, I thought I was, but obviously not anymore. So I'm going to hold on to the Dick Butka story. I just like that story too much.
It's a good story.
You know, it's a good story. So if we can't disprove it, let's just call it true and move on. That's my approach at this point. Any other fascinating facts you uncovered about the diaconate that would be of interest, do you think, to our listeners?
You know, really, I think one of the things that's always been that I've admired about the diaconate program and the men and their wives that have been involved is the devotion to it, the devotion to service. Learning and being formed and learning what they're learning, as well as having mentors and speaking and really wanting that desire to be involved in service. One of the first ministries that they've gotten was Deacon Robichaud, was this service to the incarcerated, prison ministry.
Yeah.
That was a very big involvement. And so I think for me, it's been the type of ministries and the involvement. I mean, even going up and through human trafficking, I've always admired that, of the office looking at where deacons need to be involved, where are we needed, who needs us, and what can we do to minister to people, and how to reach out, not only in their own parishes, but to the other people who need them, those people who are on the periphery. So I think really, whether it's the incarcerated or human trafficking or
the soup kitchens, the
housing programs, absolutely. There's just the diversity of it. And also the deacons understanding how they all fit in from the beginning of the program, where obviously nationwide, you know, how do the deacons fit in? How do we fit in with liturgy? You know, how do we fit in with laity? How do we fit in with priests and what theirs are? And to see the, you know, the patience and the understanding and the learning process of how they fit in and how they bring the importance of their calling to ministry to the service of being a deacon in the church.
Well, before we wrap up, we started generally about the diocese. We dove a little deep onto the deacons, but I want to give you the opportunity, because you deal with a lot of cool stuff. So I can't let you go without asking you about the diocesan archives. And what are a couple of your favorite items that you know of in your collection or our collection?
I have a long list, but I narrowed it down to four, even though we mentioned three. I narrowed it down to four.
Okay, I'll give you that. You've given such good information today.
Thank you.
You get four instead of three. Okay.
One of my favorite things is Bishop Dorsey's Passionist Habit, because Bishop Dorsey was a Passionist. And one of the things that endeared me to it was I'd read in one of his articles that one of the things he missed when he became a bishop was not being able to wear his habit anymore. That pulled on his heartstrings. And so the fact that we have his habit is very precious. It's a very precious part of it because it was so much a part of his heart.
And it's on display at the San Pedro Spiritual Development Center.
It is there, and I almost didn't let it go there because I wanted it here at the Chancery, but I thought, no, we need to put our history out there. Yeah, we need to share it. And so that was something that I really wanted them to have out there, and so that is there on display. We have croziers of Bishop Grady and Bishop Dorsey, which are wonderful because a lot of times they go to the family sometimes. So we have two of their croziers. I also, this is a fairly recent, I have a Zucchetto that was worn by Pope Francis.
Oh, wow.
That
That's
Father
cool.
Dominic brought back from Rome.
Did he steal it off his head? I know Father Dominic well enough.
I have a photograph, and he's standing there with Bishop Noonan. So Bishop Noonan sanctioned it, and they're negotiating because Father Dominic had a replacement for him.
Right.
And he just took it right off his head and gave it to him.
Oh, that's so Francis.
So I do have a Zucchetto of Pope Francis.
That's
so
very cool. Okay. All right. Well, that's only three. Oh, no. Are you counting the current
verses? Well, the fourth one. Okay. I'll do a fourth one.
Good.
And I guess it goes back to Bishop Dorsey, although there's so many. But Bishop Dorsey kept a diary when he was in formation in the seminary up in New York. And it's a beautiful diary about his experiences, about what he felt going through formation and the people he met, the people who he tried to help. And it's very short. He talks about his family. But again, it's a glimpse into how a young man felt going through formation. We are very privileged to have those two diaries.
So the last two that you mentioned, obviously, really cool. I mean, they're all cool, but those are really cool for me. Are those displayed somewhere? Or we try to figure that out?
The diaries are not, because I need to keep those safe
and
those
and
curves.
That, right, and exactly.
The Zucchetto will be going on display. I'm actually working now on creating a display that's going to go in the lobby in the chancery. And the other things are on display.
Okay, that's wonderful.
And she also helps the churches in doing their history, because we've got a lot of churches that are old.
Yes,
you
we
know,
do.
75, 100 years old, over 100 years old, a couple of them.
We do. Mm-hmm.
You know, something struck me the other day when I was at St. Charles Borromeo, and Deacon Paul took me around the corner and showed me the corpus from the fire when that church burned down. Was that the original cathedral for the diocese?
St. Charles was the original cathedral. Okay. Yes, it was, until it burned in late 1976.
Yeah, that was really profound to see, though, and it just struck me that that's history right in front of me there.
And as an archivist, I'm very pleased that they kept that as well as some other things, because that doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Renee, this was better than I even expected.
Cool.
So thank you for sharing all these wonderful insights with us today. I could talk about this literally for hours, but our producer, Catherine, is glaring at me right now as I say that. She'd probably start throwing things at me if I did. But here's a promise you have to make me now, with me, okay? If you find the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, or the Dial of Destiny somewhere in one of your vaults, can you please let us know? We will definitely bring you back on the program for that.
I will do that. Indiana Jones is one of my favorite, and yes, I will.
Okay, awesome. Well, I appreciate it. You are our own personal Indiana Jones, and we loved having you here today.
Thank you. I really loved being here. I would be glad to come again sometime.
Okay. Well, we
Thank
may
you
take
so
you
much.
Up on that offer. So what's next on the menu at the Deacon's Den? Well, I have a multiple choice question for you. When your priest or deacon gets up to give the homily, do you A, read the bulletin, B, take a nap, C, check your text messages, or D, listen intently to see how the Word of God may be speaking to you in your life? Now, of course, every homilist hopes you answer D, but we know that that isn't always the case. So join us next time as we bring in a special guest to talk about the art of homiletics, as we discuss what makes for a good homily, as well as dissecting a recorded homily to see where it hit the mark and how it can be improved. Well, sadly, we've reached closing time of the Den, but we're glad you've dropped by. Come back in when you hunger for hearty discussions on the diaconate and Catholic conversation. Until we meet again, we pray you walk closely with God on life's journey. And when you feel the urge to visit the Deacon's Den, remember, there's always a corner booth reserved just for you.